Welcome to this conversation with Dr. Joseph A. Otis. I'm Sarah White. I'm a retired director of pharmacy that has an interest in effective pharmacy leadership. Our purpose in this conversation with successful leaders is to hear in their own words aspects of their career so that we can glean for you, the audience, tips or lessons. Because remember, leadership is somewhat different than being a good pharmacist. Briefly, Dr. Otis's career, he received his pharmacy education at Duquesne University. He's worked as a staff pharmacist, an assistant director, and a chief pharmacist before he moved into association work with the American Hospital Association and the executive director for ASHP. He's also been honored by a number of awards, the most significant being the Remington Award for All of Pharmacy, the Harvey A. K. Whitney Lecture Award, the highest award in health system pharmacy for his international work, the Frankie Medal, and the Badot Award. Welcome, Doctor.
Thank you, Sarah. It's a pleasure to be here and an honor to be invited to this discussion.
Joe, tell us the stories around how you got into pharmacy and how you got into hospital pharmacy.
Well, I always say that life is a series of coincidences. I was a young man of immigrant Italian parents who didn't speak much English, and so Italian was our language in our home until I was literally in grade school. And of course, while my parents weren't well-educated, they were good people. They were good people who taught their children the values of life, the need to work hard, to be committed to the things you do. And to love music. So in our household, we had instruments all over the house, and I was studying the violin. So when it came time to go to college, we didn't have much career development and planning in those days. I did want to go to college, and I thought, well, I'll study music, become the greatest violinist in the world, perhaps, you know. Then there was the coincidence that we had a young parish priest who had gone to Duquesne University, and he was an assistant pastor in our mission church. And he took me to Duquesne to introduce me to the School of Music. And just as an aside, he said, let's stop in and see if the dean of the School of Pharmacy is in. And we did. And on a Saturday afternoon, the dean gave me about 15 minutes of his time. And literally, I had no knowledge at all about pharmacy. We had a local drugstore, and that was my extent of what I knew about pharmacy. But I walked out of the dean's office, and I said, that's the gentleman I want to study with. There was something about his personality, his magnetism that he portrayed, the goodness, the sincerity and honesty, and things of that sort. And so I applied and went to pharmacy school. And I was selected, and there we were. And this was right at the end of World War II, when all the GIs were coming back, so it was quite something, this 17-year-old to be in with veterans of a war. But I enjoyed it. Then I discovered, as a freshman, that there was also a nun who was a junior. And that nun turned out to be the Sister of Mercy who taught me Sunday school when I was a youngster in Muse, Pennsylvania. So I went down to Mercy Hospital, several blocks from the school, on one occasion, and reintroduced myself to her, and she said, would you like to work here? Well, here again, I had no knowledge that there were pharmacies in hospitals. And I said, sure, and she said, I can't pay you, but I'll give you 3 meals a day in a room. That was pretty substantial, you know. And so for 4 years I did that, and that was my entry into hospital pharmacy. Everything a coincidence.
So other people, think about the other people that have been influential in your career. And tell us a little bit about what it was that they did that helped you.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we speak of the word mentor nowadays. I don't believe we use that word quite the way we use it now. But there were people who were just good and honest and willing to help. And my parents had to be the first examples, of course. Sister Gonzalez, as my Sunday school teacher, the parish priest who took me to Duquesne. Those were some of the very critical moments, you know, where I was formulating in my mind perhaps what I was going to end up doing. And it all worked out, to my satisfaction at least, yeah.
So those people reached out to you, helped you, took an interest in you.
That's right.
And that sort of is what mentors do?
They were doing that, except we didn't call it that.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Then when you got out of pharmacy school, you went to work as a pharmacist at mm-hmm. Mercy, mm-hmm. in a hospital pharmacy, and that was sort of the early 50s. What did pharmacists do? What was practice like at that point in time?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it was a whole lot different than what it is now. This was in the era, of course, where we were memorizing what the USP and the National Formulary, because we had to know how drugs were formulated and how they acted in the body and so on. But we did a lot of compounding. We prepared powder papers. We made suppositories. We stayed pretty much in the pharmacy. It was a challenge to leave the pharmacy and go throughout the institution to visit patients or work with physicians. That was just beginning to evolve about that time. But every time you attempted to offer assistance to nursing or medical staff and so on, there was a little bit of skepticism, a little bit of suspicion. What's this? What are these people up to? What are they trying to tell me how to practice my profession and so on? And so those barriers were there, but gradually they started to break down. Yep.
Fairly quickly, you became a chief pharmacist, which today would be called the director of pharmacy. Mm-hmm. And as you began to try to expand pharmacy services, talk a little bit more about what sort of reactions you got from nurses and physicians and administrators.
Well, you know, pharmacists in those days, as I mentioned earlier, literally stayed in the pharmacy. I recall that the nurses would come down to the pharmacy with patients' charts. And off of the patient's chart, we would record the medication ordered by the physician. So you can imagine now, nowadays, with all the electronic stuff we've got, that those charts left the floors and were left in the pharmacy so we could extract the drug information we needed. And as a result, see everything focused in on the pharmacy, and there wasn't the opportunity, unless you had the courage to extend out, to say, go up on the floors and visit with people up there. I remember when I went to West Penn Hospital, I used to make it a point to go walking through the floors, and every time I walked along, I felt like somebody was going to let me have it in the back, you know, because that was not the traditional thing. And we were sort of strangers up there. And to ask to look at a chart or see a patient, that was way out, you know. But gradually, when people started to understand that we weren't trying to invade anything, all we wanted to do was to be helpful, to be participants in the care of patients and things of that sort, it started to work.
And it didn't, when you were up there and you felt like you were kind of on somebody's other territory, it didn't stop you from doing it, though.
Absolutely not.
You knew that we needed to expand.
That's right. That's
Is that
right.
Correct?
That's right. Yeah.
Well,
it was obvious, you know, and that the pharmacy couldn't be just a compounder. Besides, the industry, you know, was coming along, developing extremely well, and taking over the functions of preparing, making drugs. And so there was another function that was more vital, and that is was to know how drugs acted in a disease state and how, in collaboration with nursing and physicians, we could make judgments as to what was the best drug in the right disease state. Yeah.
As you think about your career, are there lessons, tips that you wish you'd have learned earlier rather than later?
Life is a whole a big tip. You sort of evolve, you know. You start out somewhere, and based on your experiences as one goes along in life, depending on the values you hold, then you develop in a positive way. I've never looked back, should I have done something another way. The idea was keep moving forward, you know. And I think that's important to know. It's the same thing as perhaps losing a job or missing an opportunity. Well, you can dwell on that, get you nowhere. In the meantime, a lot of doors that are opening there, you don't see them, where the opportunities are, yeah.
You, speaking of opportunities, you had an opportunity fairly soon to take a position with the American Hospital Association. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the circumstances around that and making that kind of a career shift from practice into organization work.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I decided before going to college was that I was not interested in medicine, I thought, simply because I didn't think I had the courage to handle a person's life, you know. And yet I got into pharmacy and discovered very soon that I could kill people if I didn't know what I was doing. And so from that, I developed an interest in maybe going to medical school, and indeed took extra courses and so on. Something came along called the Korean conflict. And as a consequence, I was drafted in the Army and so on. When I came back out of the service, I got involved organizationally. And I also started thinking about that time that maybe hospital administration was the thing I really wanted to do, and gave some thought to going to school to get a master's degree. During that time, I became president of the Western Pennsylvania Society, one of our society chapters, and whatever I did there focused attention, got the attention of some people. And the American Hospital Association at the time was looking, had created a new position of hospital pharmacist consultant on the staff. And I got the invitation, and I said, this sounds pretty good, let's go.
So being involved in professional organizations was very helpful to your career.
Absolutely, yeah. And I would, and not only that, but you know, you make contributions in different ways. You can make them clinically, you can make them professionally, you can make them organizationally. If you're always moving to make a contribution, you'll find the right spot in which to do that. Yeah.
Now, did you have, at that point in your career, did you have a master career plan that this opportunity sort of fit into, or was it an opportunity that made sense to you because you relocated your family for
yes,
this?
Yes, I did, yeah. Well, Sarah, I have a belief that all of us are here for a purpose. And if you have that belief, then you have to find out what our purpose is in life. And so career planning for me was just to always be alert to opportunities that helped me do the job on earth that was expected of me. And you drift one way and then you drift another way, but and this is not to say that there shouldn't be career planning as such as we know it today. It's simply to say, don't rely on that entirely. If indeed you have a belief in our purpose in life. Because if you rely too much on a formula for career planning, I've seen experiences where there have been great, great disappointments because you're so focused on heading in one direction in one particular role, and then all the other opportunities pass you by. And I think that's what drove me to AHA in Chicago, and I think that's what drove me back to ASHP when that call came as well.
Did it seem like a risk to leave practice, or were those things you even thought about? It just made sense, or comment a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, remember I said that I started in the belief that I didn't want to do anything in medicine. I ended up in pharmacy. Then I thought I might go to medicine. Then I thought, well, hospital administration might be. I think all those things were building blocks, you know. And I don't think I ever formulated a strategy. I think it was just the process that was evolving inside of me, and with the belief that we're here to do a good job, whatever that call is. You know.
I know a lot of younger practitioners think a lot about, you know, taking calculated risks, making career moves. What advice might you have if you could sit down with one of them and they ask you, how should I think about this?
Mm-hmm. The risk factor is real and has to be taken into consideration. One has to have confidence in oneself. That's terribly important. If you're going to look just at the risks, then you're probably going to just hang around for a long time doing not much of anything constructive. But if you have confidence in yourself, belief that you can make a contribution, want to make a contribution, then there's no great risk. You know, it'll somehow work out. You'll find a way. Might not work the first time, another door will open.
So from AHA then, you had the opportunity to go to work basically for APHA in the mm-hmm. hospital pharmacy division and then become the executive secretary of ASHP. Mm-hmm. Is that?
Well, the positions came simultaneously. And so I really wore two hats when I came to Washington, the one with the ASHP and the one with the American Pharmaceutical Association. But the Division of Hospital Pharmacy in APHA really was providing service to the ASHP, which had no full-time CEO leadership. Now they had hired me to be that. And so it became obvious within about a year's time that the need for a Division of Hospital Pharmacy within APHA was not critical. And by agreement with APHA, we dissolved that division. And so I ended up being the CEO of ASHP.
So when you started, you were the first full-time staff person. What other resources did you have at that point in time?
Okay. I was the first CEO full-time. The society did have one full-time staff person, a gentleman by the name of George Provo, who worked out of Arkansas on the American Hospital Formulary Service. When I came to Washington, on reflection, you know, you talk about risk. I wasn't smart enough to ask the right questions of what's the budget look like and all this sort of thing. I just was enamored with the notion that here's an opportunity to do something good and somehow it'll work out. Well, I ended up with myself and two young ladies. That was our staff. And then I discovered that we had half times, part times, third times around the country. And an office in Hamilton, Illinois, where our journal was published, Formulary Service in Little Rock, Arkansas, our journal in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Well, just going around and visiting and doing the arithmetic on all of that, we had a staff, but it was in bits and pieces and had to be brought together and consolidated and centralized. And that was the first task we did. Yeah.
Do you remember roughly how many members in ASHP at that point in time?
About 3,000.
3,000, okay. Yeah. And I've heard you comment that you financially barely had a couple of nickels to rub together,
That's right. That's why I say if I'd worried about the risk, I wouldn't have taken the job because the total budget of the society was reliant on dues, and dues were about $2 or $3 a person. I think our good year was about $30,000 a year to pay for myself and two young ladies. So we weren't being paid very much. The small sums were still okay then, you know. But then when we consolidated everything, we really realized that there was about $250,000 operation, except it had to be pulled together and formalized and so on, yeah.
Now, 37 years later, mm-hmm. you retired. How many members roughly was ASHP? What sort of numbers of staff and what sort of numbers of budget?
Yeah, we by that time we were at about 32,000 members. We had a staff that was approaching 200, and our budget then probably was about 35 million, more or less.
And you built that, Joe, from that starting point. How do you feel about those accomplishments?
Well, it makes you feel good, you know. But it wasn't just myself. It was the people that we hired and brought on board. And it was a lot of, I keep using the word coincidence, because, you know, observing what was happening in practice and then saying, how do we develop services to help our members function in this new environment that's developing? I'll give you an example. We had the journal, American Journal of Hospital Pharmacy, and in our annual budget, we had an item of revenue called reprints. And reprints was maybe $500 a year. And these were reprints from our journal that our members requested. It wasn't, we had extra journals, and we cut the reprint out and send it and charge maybe 50 cents or something. Well, that figure started to grow and grow, and pretty soon, you know, it was about $25,000. And I thought, well, what are we doing to make this happen? We were doing nothing, just what was happening around us. So I suggested, I challenged our people on the board. I said, if we can do $25,000 a year without any effort at all, if we hire someone, can we do $250,000 a year? And that launched our publication program, mm-hmm. which now probably, I don't know the right figures now, but probably represent maybe 40% of the income to ASHP, you know.
And in ASHP was formed in 1942. Mm-hmm. You took over in 1960. But as I've read, of the 153 charter members of ASHP in 1942, 44% were women. Could you comment on women's involvement? Mm-hmm. Because it wasn't until 1978 that there was a woman president of ASHP.
Right.
So comment a little bit about that
okay.
for us.
Yeah. Well, women were involved in ASHP. See, the structure of the board at that time was not a totally elected board. The membership elected the president-elect, and the president-elect then appointed chairman of standing committees. And so women would appear on the board by appointment, and it depended on who the president was as to what, and they were all male, of course, as you mentioned, until first female. And but then the women usually were secretary or treasurer or some category like that. And it's interesting that in the early days of the society, there were many religious women who were members, and that was at the time when you could tell what a religious, who was a religious, because of the dress that they had at the time, you know, and different orders and all different styles and so on. And it was always fascinating to me that more often than not, the treasurer of the society, with these few dollars we really had, happened to be a nun. And I always wondered why a nun always ended up being treasurer. And I inherited one, Sister Berenice, who was treasurer for 12 years, I think. And I assumed that they took a vow of poverty. And so the few dollars we had probably were safe in their hands, you know.
It's interesting as I think about the involvement of women, in that I was in high school in the early 60s. Mm-hmm. And I remember very vividly being nominated for student body president and declining it and saying it should be a man.
Yeah.
And how I've changed over my career, but society has changed.
Right.
So I think the key tip is women have always been very involved, and mm-hmm. it's been more recent in leadership positions, but leaders behind the scenes.
That's right.
Is sort of how I interpret that.
That's right. And I can see that very clearly in my grandchildren, female grandchildren. Don't stand in my way, you know. No encouragement there. They're out and running and full speed, yeah.
Over your 37 years, Joe, you've worked with a lot of different elected officials, mm-hmm. board members, presidential people, who've all had very different personalities and very different agendas. How have you managed that people challenge all of your career?
Well, you have to love life and love people. And if you believe in honesty and truthfulness and things like that, it's not so hard. One has to ask, when I ask what is the one word that might characterize the essential in all of this, I say it's patience. Not only one patience, but patience, patience, patience. You know, in real estate, they say it's location, location, location. Well, in association work, but it's true also in the institutional setting where we work, you have to have patience and be sincere and demonstrate your honesty and be a good listener and make sure that any idea that's tossed out is considered, not just set aside. And those, it seems to me, are very simple elements of life. And if we'd only adhere to those things, of course, that's a challenge nowadays in this fast-moving society of ours, but I think they're still fundamentals.
If you think about all of these very successful elected people that you've worked with, what are some characteristics of those that have been very successful? What are characteristics, do you think, of successful people?
Well, my sense is that I think I did a count once of how many people in 38 years that I was there that I might have interacted with, and it was pretty high. But I found that whether they were on the board or on the council or might be a participant in one of our educational programs, people had much the same characteristics. They had the desire to serve, the desire to help humanity, their ambitions were there, but those weren't predominant, I should say. They were there to help promote this interest and wish to help people who are sick and advancing in age and things of that sort. So it's not a big secret.
Over the years in building ASHP, you hired and developed a number of really superb staff. Mm-hmm. How did you go about that in developing the culture within the ASHP staff?
Mm-hmm. Well, I came from a family where there was love and lots of it, and a lot of patience and a lot of encouragement. And I simply applied what I had learned growing up to try to develop a similar culture at ASHP. And I always considered ASHP staff a family. And we would do things throughout the year where not only were the staff members a part of this development, but we brought in literally their families as well through various types of functions. And so as a result, it became a family community. Not unlike, really, the family community at pharmacy, where we have differences and so on, but if you approach it that way, it works, and it has been working.
Tell me about your thinking in developing and conducting an executive residency program at mm-hmm. ASHP.
Well, when I was at the American Hospital Association, I learned a great deal about association management just by my presence there, and I was given opportunities to operate at the presidential levels of the association and met a number of wonderful leaders and learned a little bit about what it makes things tick if you're in the association world. When I came to ASHP, and from a beginning of three people, we were expanding and had developed programs and organized ourselves in a way that we could continue to serve membership well. On the plane with Dr. McConnell, I turned to him over a drink and I said, you know, we must be doing something right. We didn't go to pharmacy school to be association executives. We went there to practice pharmacy. But we, life is such that we're now in the association world. And I said, we're going to need leaders. And whatever it is we're doing, maybe we can make a contribution to developing leaders. And that's where the idea of an executive residency came along, to train someone to spend a year with us, learn from what we were doing, and then step into the world and perhaps apply the things learned with us. And we had three objectives in mind. One was, we knew that we would need good people on our staff in the future. So some of those executive residents stayed with us and then went off when they were finished. The second one was that our state chapters. Now, there wasn't a state chapter that had a paid executive. But we were thinking way out and said, sooner or later, some of our state chapters are going to need CEOs. They'll be able to afford one. And so we were preparing people perhaps for that role. And then thirdly, even if the first two didn't work, as long as we prepared pharmacists, and they didn't have to be pharmacists either, in the association management world, they might go into the nursing association or the medical association or the podiatry association, wherever. Our influence would be a penetration into all those areas. And I think we've had about 30 executive residents now, and they're all over the place and doing good jobs.
If you think about the executive residents, what are the characteristics of the best residents when they were residents? What made them, I guess, or enabled them to learn as much as they could?
Well, they had free rein. And while they were students, in effect, with us residents, they sat in on all corporate staff meetings. They had a role in the budget development. They had, we took the resident always to critical meetings with other associations, and they got that exposure which gradually prepared them for what association management is about.
How did you attempt to mentor them?
A lot of evening sessions. I had the habit of opening up the boardroom at 5 o'clock every night. And every staff member was invited to stop in, have a visit, perhaps have a cold drink, eat some peanuts or something. And the resident was always there, of course. And but you know, that notion was a form where the day was over. Sometimes you couldn't get to someone during the day, but at that hour, you just said, how about meeting upstairs in the boardroom? And we came up with all kinds of great ideas in that environment, because there was no formality. And you know, once the juices start churning there, ideas came out for new publications, for new activities, new ways of serving the membership and so on. The resident was always part of that. Usually, some would hang along around a good time that evening, and sooner or later you had to feed them. And so we'd go out to dinner, and those were my seminars with residents. Yeah.
So a good part of that was just you spending time with them, including them in things, and being part of their learning.
This is exactly right. Yeah, you had to give them time, sure.
In building ASHP, obviously one of the challenges was developing non-dues sources of incomes. Mm-hmm. And how did all of that come about? How did you end up 8 years later with a good budget?
Okay. Well, there was a gentleman that I knew, that all of American Pharmacy knows, internationally also, Dr. Don Franke. And I guess if I had a mentor, I could include him as a mentor in a different way. I just observed what he did and how he behaved. If he had an idea and he thought through that idea and satisfied himself that it was a good one, and he had to present it to a board of directors for approval, or whomever had to give approval, if it wasn't going to, it wasn't receiving approval attention, he didn't get discouraged by that or argue, you know, strongly for it. He simply took his idea and put it back in his briefcase. You could bet your bottom dollar that somewhere along the line, a year, maybe 2, 5 years, Don would reach in his briefcase and come out with the idea again. And that was a critical lesson for me, because when I went with the American Hospital Association, for example, we used to have these educational retreats, but we never permitted the pharmaceutical industry to participate. And I guess we were, I don't know what we were then, we didn't trust each other or something. And yet, we would complain that the drugs that were prepared for us weren't in the form we should have them, and the industry was trying to guess as to what we needed, and there was no communication. So I suggested to the American Hospital Association, why don't we experiment and have a pharmacy meeting where we open the door not only to our practitioners, but to the industry, to the educators, to the regulatory bodies, and so on and so on. And let's see what happens. Well, like Don Franke, that idea wasn't accepted, so I took it, put it in my briefcase, came to Washington. About 2 years at ASHP, I brought it out again. The board almost refused to do that, but they tolerated me, and we put on the first meeting with 250 people. And of course, the story is that is now what we call a mid-year clinical meeting, where we get 20,000 people a year. What that demonstrated to me was that there was a need for that, and the communication process had been stifled. And once you opened up the doors, there was no threat to anybody. Everybody gained. Mm-hmm. And so that, of course, was another means of increasing the budget of the society, not because we were in the business of trying to just make money, but we were providing a service. And the service paid abundantly. So today, I guess that's probably a $10 million gross income per year, you know.
So that may be one of those lessons learned earlier about if you don't get what you want the first time, there's a time and a place
That's
later,
right.
perhaps.
Timing is everything.
Or a change in it to get it. Now, there were some guidelines, were there not, around what the pharmaceutical industry could do as you implemented them in? Could they do programming and influence programming in the meetings?
Oh, no. There were strict guidelines. And I think those guidelines still exist today. And of course, with the attention now on drugs in Congress and every place else, they've become even more stringent. But nobody was hurt by it. Everybody learned a lot. Everybody profited. And yeah, you know, once in a while you get someone breaking a rule, but you have to put up with that too.
It was kind of a win-win.
That's right.
And you always strove to do that, to have a win-win. And take care of what needed to be done, but not compromise values.
Exactly, exactly. Well, you know, it's the same thing in pharmacy unity, which to me was one of the greatest challenges I had, because we had all these pharmacy associations, and the parent of all of these associations, more or less, was the American Pharmaceutical Association. And when that was formed, well, then that was it. But as time went on, different specialties started to develop. And there was always an attempt to force everybody into a single association, which wasn't possible. And no one was going to accept that. And didn't. But there was still a need to have the pharmacy family. And finally, we created, as you know, the Joint Commission of Pharmacy Practitioners. And we created it in such a way that no one was the leader there. That we were all leaders at one time or another, because the chair rotated, the chief executive officers and the elected presidential officers had to meet committed to meet every quarter. We had to eyeball each other all the time. And instead of, you know, then going to the press and issuing news releases and complaining about one or the other, we found that there was nothing worthwhile in that. 3 months later, we had to look at each other and sit across the table and so on. And that was sobering. And the other thing we discovered was that we were arguing about 5% of the things that bothered us. 95% we agreed on. We just never talked about the ones we agreed on. We always emphasized the ones that where we had disputes with one another. And they weren't really disputes, they were just the nature of where we practice created these sorts of things, and we just have simply had to accept that. Well, the Joint Commission now has been in operation probably 25 years, maybe more. They're still meeting quarterly, the execs and the elected officials. And I don't think I've seen a news release critical of one of the pharmacy family members in all that time.
And that, to me, that's an example of finding the common ground.
That's right.
And coming up with the system, like rotating the leadership of it, that makes it comfortable for everybody, mm-hmm. to get them at the table and then continue the dialogue and work on the bigger issues.
That's exactly right.
And yeah, and right. You've navigated through a number of those, I would term them controversial issues, you know, the PharmD degree.
Mm-hmm.
What was your thinking about how to handle these very controversial issues? Because we all face them in our careers.
Well, you just have to communicate. You have to sit down and talk, and instead of writing letters to one another and issuing news releases, you say, let's get over, sit down over coffee or something. Let's hide ourselves away someplace and commit ourselves for a day or two and see what we can come up with. If one has respect for another, then that's easy to do. If our ambitions get in the way of things, then that creates problems. And once again, it's living the life that we're on Earth for, you know.
Some of the people that have worked for you have expressed to me that you always had a plan B when you went after something. Do you want to talk about that philosophy that they learned from you?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know that I ever thought of it that way, but I guess I always had, if A doesn't work, then B is worth a try, and nothing formal about that. I think that was just...
Well, it's sort of like my sense of working with you all these years, that if you didn't get exactly what you wanted, you weren't going to walk away.
Oh, no, you get as much as you can.
Yeah.
And wait for another time.
Exactly.
And then, because if it's something that's slightly controversial, where there are strong differing viewpoints, well then, you have to give it time to trust. A trust has to come into the picture. So you take as much as you can and take your first step, and then time comes along, you take your second step, and so on and so on. You know, this is the perfect example of this was when Medicare came into being. And when we would go to the educators in the early 40s and 50s and say, you're not training us to be institutional pharmacists. The answer from the deans always was, essentially, 95% of our graduates go into retail pharmacy. Only 5% go into institutional practice. So that made sense. That's how we started our residency programs. Said, okay, if you won't train us, we'll train ourselves. And wow, that's a huge success, as you know, you're part of it. When Medicare came along and the clinical concepts started to develop and educators were beginning to change the curriculum and so on, what was evident was that they needed laboratories, and the laboratories were the hospitals. And that was perfect timing, you know, because then we were beginning to grow. This mid-year clinical meeting came on us right at the right time. Residencies were in process then, and so it was an external factor that made it possible for us to achieve the things we had been hoping to achieve, see. So that's another lesson in life, too. Watch for those those moments where you don't have any control over something, but if you find the right moment, you can make use of it.
It's sort of that seizing an opportunity
exactly.
and making the most of it.
Exactly right, yeah, yeah.
The ASHP original constitution was to develop a minimum standard, mm-hmm. which was done. Talk a little bit about the evolution of practice standards
okay.
within ASHP and their impact.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, the minimum standard was the first one. And then along came a standard on internship training, I think is what we called it at the time. But while I was at the American Hospital Association, we had a joint committee with the ASHP, four members from each side. And I recall, you know, I came out of practice where we were filling prescriptions and compounding and so on. At the end of the day, I knew exactly what I achieved. I went with AHA, and for the first month, at the end of the month, I went to my boss and I said, you know, I'm ashamed to take my salary. I can't count anything that I achieved, you know. Said, and her advice to me was, give yourself a year. And that was good advice, because what we were doing at AHA, what you do at an organization, is something that impacts over a lasting period. What we used to do as practitioners was something you could count every day. And it became also a question, question I would get when we tried to hire newer members out of pharmacy who were clinically trained and say, am I going to lose my clinical skills? I'd have to admit, you're not going to be as sharp on clinical skills if you come with us. But if you stay with us long enough, you'll see the outcome of your work that will not be a momentary thing, but it'll have a lasting thing. And this was the practice standards. And I found when I was AHA that after I got that good advice from my boss, by the end of that year, we didn't call it a practice standard, but we had a statement on pharmacy and therapeutics committee, a statement on pharmaceutical service in small hospital, statement on the use of investigational drugs in hospitals, and we had the nucleus for the statement on formulary systems, which then also was endorsed by American Medical Association, American Pharmaceutical Association. Now I could see the measurement.
Is it true, Joe, that when Medicare was enacted and then when Joint Commission revised its standards, that they picked up and incorporated many of the practice standards that ASHP had developed?
That's exactly right. I remember when the Joint Commission used to issue a bulletin periodically, and on this one occasion, in the bulletin was a requirement that you had to have a pharmacy and therapeutics committee in the hospital based on the statement we had developed. And that was the beginning of that sort of thing, and the cooperation that exists between ASHP and Joint Commission is wonderful, and in the interest of patient care, because all we're trying to do and what they're trying to do is similar, you know, in different ways. Yeah.
The development of residency programs and the ASHP really subsidizing the accreditation process.
That's right.
Talk a little bit about that commitment to the profession and training new people.
Well, you're absolutely right. We started the residency program through a small grant. And the history of that might be important because while we had a standard and people said they had residencies or internships, as we call them then, we had no way of really knowing whether the standard was being met. So we decided to do the accreditation process. The first step there was to send out an appeal. Anybody claims they have a residency or internship, let us know. Then we sent them all a long questionnaire to see if they really understood what the standard was about. I think we had about 90 or so people fill out the questionnaire. The review of that question, the answers, brought us down to about 50 that might qualify. And then we went out and literally examined those 50. And we ended up, I think, with 32. That was the beginning of our residency accredited program. And now, of course, it's the figures are staggering at the moment.
But to run that accreditation process, the fees that were paid did not cover that.
There were no fees.
Oh.
There were no fees. And in fact, every time I'd say to the board as the thing took on activity, you know, and grew, I'd say, isn't it time we should charge a small fee? No, no fee. I don't remember how many years we went on that way, subsidizing it. And it was a good decision.
It was an investment.
That's right.
In
it was
profession.
A good decision. And you asked earlier about the people serving on the board. Those were the type of people that I experienced on the board throughout my 38 years, yeah.
Talk about the formation of the ASHP Research and Education Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And you're thinking about that and, you know, its purpose and et cetera.
Okay. Well, here again, a lesson from my experience at AHA. AHA had a foundation. And I learned a little bit about why. And the basic why is that people who are successful, or even if they're not successful, but want to help develop programs, services, and things that will be in the interest of the public health, are willing to put up money. But if you don't have a foundation where you can make a contribution that's tax deductible, they probably will be reluctant to give it to your professional society, which doesn't give you that privilege. And I saw it work at the American Hospital Association, and it made sense to me that while we were in a stage of infancy, really, the time would come where we would have people making good salaries, being very successful themselves, and not only our own members, but people who had an interest in what we were about, and they wanted to be a part of that. And so that's how we created the foundation. And of course, Steve Allen is doing a great job on that now, you know. He probably has a bigger organization now, by far, than I had in 1960 when I went there. He's talking thousands and thousands of dollars. I was talking a few dollars.
Well, and I just want to comment that these conversations are funded by the ASHP Research and Education Foundation.
That's correct.
Talk a little bit about your philosophy around the Scholar in Residence program through the foundation.
Well, you mentioned how you latched onto that. When we were celebrating, I think, our 25th anniversary of the society, I wrote a little paper. My job was to look into the future and project on a couple of things. I think I came up with about 10 projections, one of which was that in time we would have established at ASHP something akin to a chair that's established in the university, where we could bring on staff someone that could deal with an issue, do a study, pursue a course of action, and wouldn't have to worry about the politics of it or reporting to a board of directors or anything of that sort. Just a scholarly type of work. And then you came along, and the title of the program that you participated was Scholar in Residence. And you tied those two things together. I guess that's what I had in mind, but I used a different term.
Yeah, I would comment, Joe, that as I retired from being the director at Stanford Hospital, I was wanting to do some things professionally, and the association said, why don't you think about it? And so I came to Washington, D.C. for 4 months and studied leadership. Mm-hmm. And again, it was an opportunity to do something I had a real passion around without all the politics and all the other things,
yeah.
And then published some data that's led to all kinds of speaking other opportunities. So all of that is made possible from your vision, from the foundation and its funding, in which members can contribute to as well as industry contribute to.
And they should.
Yeah, and
they
should,
yeah.
Definitely.
You know, there's an old saying. We had a past president who just died, Leo Godley. And his inaugural address had a phrase in it, every man owes a debt to his profession. And that's true today as it was back then when Leo was president. And giving to the foundation fulfills that, because out of the foundation then comes things that each of us individually can't perform, but collectively, bringing the forces together, we can do great things.
You've been very involved throughout your career in international pharmacy. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that and your leadership roles in FIP.
Well, here again, I go back to Don Franke, who had been active in the International Pharmaceutical Federation. And in my, I think in 62 or 63, was my first international meeting in Vienna. And in fact, it was preceded by the Italian Society of Hospital Pharmacists meeting in Milano when they were celebrating their 10th anniversary. And I'm diverging a little bit, but being an Italian myself, when I went there, I felt compelled to bring greetings in Italian, which I did, after a lot of preparation and study and everything else. And I was enthusiastically received, obviously. You know, Italians are very emotional. But the problem was that throughout the week then, everybody expected me to speak fluent Italian, which I couldn't do at all. But anyway, that was the first stop on the way to Vienna, my first FIP meeting. And I got involved immediately. I knew that Don Franke fully supported that sort of notion. Gloria as well, attended many of those meetings. And gradually, over the years, I became the president of the hospital section. And from that, I was invited to become a member of the board of the FIP, and then eventually was elected president and served 4 years as president.
Were there differences, or what were the differences in leading ASHP and leading an international organization in pharmacy?
Well, the fundamentals are all the same. Where the differences are is the cultures you have to deal with. On my board at the time for 4 years, I had representatives from France, England, Nigeria, Sweden, Denmark, Australia, Poland, I believe, and so on. So it becomes a question of translations, becomes a question of what did he really say just now, and things of that sort. But if you have good people, those are not obstacles that can't be overcome. They, in fact, I think sometimes even enhance what you're trying to do.
Did residencies, the concept of a residency, start as internships at the University of Michigan with Whitney and Franke?
I think pretty much. Also in a New York hospital, forgotten the name of it there, there was an element of that. But also, you know, we had people from Ohio like Spies. They were prominent people. Louis Zoff from Iowa, who was a hospital pharmacist and became dean. All of that congealed and came together. But I think the real force probably was Michigan there, yeah.
And they called them internships, mm-hmm. but they were sort of year-long.
That's right.
Training and evolved into residencies that then ASHP accredited mm-hmm. and over the years has trained a number of key leaders in
yes,
the country.
Yes, they have, yeah. They have, in fact, if you go back probably over and explore our governance at the board level of the society, my guess is there will be a predominance of people on that board who completed a residency over the period of time, yeah.
If you could sit down with younger practitioners today, what would you tell them about pharmacy and pharmacy in the future? What advice, so to speak?
Well, if you want diversity, go to pharmacy, because as I started out early on, my view of pharmacy was a corner drugstore. But now, you look at what the opportunities are. Look where it led me, into association management, You can go into research. You can go into, the clinical practice of pharmacy now is, that's got to be rewarding beyond any thought of what it could be. And so I, sure, we have our slowdowns and things like that, but we had pioneers back when the society was formed who didn't have much money and yet came to their meetings at their own expense to serve on the board of directors and so on. Nowadays, that's changed a little bit, you know. So there's more opportunity here, more, a greater chance to serve people, and just go into it. It's fascinating to see things unfold the way they are, and who knows what's out there in the future. So this is not a dying profession.
What advice do you have for current pharmacy leaders and those in the future in pharmacy? What should pharmacy leadership be all about?
Well, I guess one of the things, to be a leader, one of the things I think is that to not be possessed by your own ambitions, you know. If you're going to lead, then you have to set a good example. And then nothing stronger than good example. In fact, it's everything. And so just do what comes naturally, you know. Avoid the chance, the temptation to believe you're more than you are. And it'll work out. Your dreams will all materialize.